Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. Well, I have a variety of articles to read to you I think you'll find interesting. I hope you will. Let's get started with Dvar Torah. We are in the book of Genesis, the beginning of things. And the Parsha is called Chaye Sarah, which means the life of Sarah. Interesting, they call it the life of Sarah. It's really about Sarah's passing. But that's the title of it. Now, these commentaries that I'm reading to you are from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Great Britain, now of blessed memory. Well, he titles this, his commentaries on Chaye Sarah, as the kindness of strangers. Here's what he says. In 1966, an 11-year-old black boy moved with his parents and family to a white neighborhood in Washington. Sitting with his two brothers and two sisters on the front step of the house, he waited to see how he would be greeted. They were not greeted. Passers-by turned to look at them, but no one gave them a smile or even a glance of recognition. All the fearful stories he had heard about how whites treated blacks seemed to be coming true. Years later, writing about those first 2 days in their new home, he says, "I knew we were not welcome here. I knew we would not be liked here. I knew we would have no friends here. I knew we should not have moved here." As he was thinking those thoughts, a white woman coming home from work passed by on the other side of the road. She turned to the children with a broad smile, said, "Welcome." Disappearing into the house, she emerged minutes later with a tray laden with drinks and sandwiches, which she brought over to the children, making them feel at home. That moment, the young man later wrote, changed his life. It gave him a sense of belonging where there was none before. It made him realize, at a time when race relations in the United States were still fraught, that a black family could feel at home in a white area, and that there could be relationships that were colorblind. Over the years, he learned to admire much about the woman across the street, but it was that first spontaneous act of greeting that became for him a definitive memory. It broke down a wall of separation and turned strangers into friends. That young man, Stephen Carter, eventually became a law professor at Yale University and wrote a book about what he learned that day. He called it Civility. The name of the woman, he tells us, was Sarah Kestenbaum, and she died all too young. He adds that it was no coincidence that she was a religious Jew. In the Jewish tradition, he notes, such civility is called chesed. Literally, it means loving kindness, the doing of acts of kindness, which is, in turn, derived from the understanding that human beings are made in the image of God. Civility, he adds, itself may be seen as a part of chesed. It does indeed require kindnesses towards our fellow citizens, including the ones who are strangers, and even when it is hard. To this day, he adds, I can close my eyes and feel on my tongue the smooth, slick sweetness of cream cheese and jelly sandwiches that I gobbled up on that summer afternoon when I discovered how a single act of genuine and unassuming civility can change a life forever. I never knew Sarah Kestenbaum, but years after I had read Carter's book, I gave a lecture to the Jewish community in the part of Washington where she had lived. I told them Carter's story, which they had not heard before. But they nodded in recognition. Yes, one said, that's the kind of thing that Sarah would do. Something like this thought was surely in the mind of Abraham's servant, unnamed in the text, but traditionally identified as Eleazar. When he arrived at Nahor in Aram-Naharim, northwest Mesopotamia, to find a wife for his master's son. Abraham had not told him to look for any specific traits of character. He had simply told him to find someone from his own extended family. Eleazar, however, formulated a test. "Lord God of my master Abraham, make me successful today, and show kindness to my master Abraham. See, I am standing beside this spring, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a young woman, 'Please let down your jar that I may have a drink,' and she says, 'Drink, and I'll watch your camels too,' let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Yitzhak. By this I will know that you have shown kindness, chesed, to my master." His use of the word chesed here is no accident, for it is the very characteristic he is looking for in the future wife of the first Jewish child, Yitzhak, Isaac, and he found it in Rebekah, or Rivka. It is the theme also of the book of Ruth. It is Ruth's kindness to Naomi and Boaz's to Ruth that Tanakh seeks to emphasize in sketching the background to David, their great-grandson, who would become Israel's greatest king. Indeed, the sages said that the three characteristics most important to Jewish character are modesty, compassion, and kindness. Chesed, what I have defined elsewhere as love as deed, is central to the Jewish value system. The sages based it on the acts of God himself, Rav Simlai taught. The Torah begins with an act of kindness and ends with an act of kindness. It begins with God clothing the naked. The text is, "The Lord God made for Adam and his wife garments of skin and clothed them." That's Genesis chapter 3, verse 21. And it ends with God caring for the dead. Quote, "And he, God, buried Moses in the valley." That's Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 6. And also in Talmud Bavli, that book of Sota, 14a. Chesed, providing shelter for the homeless, food for the hungry, assistance to the poor, visiting the sick, comforting mourners, and providing a dignified burial for all, became constitutive of Jewish life. During the many centuries of exile and dispersion, Jewish communities were built around these needs. There were chevrot, friendly societies of friends, for each of them. In 17th century Rome, for example, there were seven societies dedicated to the provision of clothes, shoes, linen, beds, and warm winter bed coverings for children, for the poor, for widows and pensioners. There were two societies providing trousseaus, dowries, and the loan of jewelry to poor brides. There was one for visiting the sick, another bringing help to families who had suffered bereavement, and others to perform the last rites for those who had died, purification before burial, and the burial service itself. 11 fellowships existed for educational and religious aims, study, and for prayer. Another raised alms for Jews living in the Holy Land, and others were involved in the various activities associated with the circumcision of newborn boys. And yet others provided the poor with the means to fulfill commands, such as mezuzot for their doors, oil for the Hanukkah lights, and candles for Shabbat, for the Sabbath. Chesed, said the sages, in some respects is higher even than tzedakah. Tzedakah is often translated as charity. The literal translation is justice. Our masters taught that loving kindness, that is chesed, is greater than charity, tzedakah, in three ways. Charity is done with done with one's money, while loving kindness may be done with one's money or with one's person. Charity is done only for the poor, while loving kindness may be given to the poor and to the rich. Charity is given only to the living, while loving kindness may be shown to the living and to the dead. Chesed, in its many forms, became synonymous with Jewish life and one of the pillars on which it stood. Jews performed kindnesses to one another because it was the way of God, and also because they or their families had had intimate experience of suffering and knew they had nowhere else to turn. It provided an access of grace in dark times. It softened the blow of the loss of the temple and the rites associated with the temple. Once, as Rav Yochanan was walking out of Jerusalem, Rav Yahshua followed him. Seeing the temple in ruins, Rav Yahshua cried, "Woe to us that this place is in ruins, the place where atonement was made for Israel's iniquity." Rav Yochanan said to him, "My son, do not grieve, for we have another means of atonement which is no less effective." "What is it?" "It is deeds of loving kindness, about which Scripture says, 'I desire loving kindness and not sacrifice.'" Through Chesed, Jews humanized faith, as they believed God's Chesed humanizes the world. As God acts towards us with love, so we are called on to act lovingly to one another. The world does not operate solely on the basis of impersonal principles like power or justice, but also on the deeply personal basis of vulnerability, attachment, care, and concern, recognizing us as individuals with unique needs and potentialities. It also added a word to the English language. In 1535, Miles Coverdale published the first ever translation of the Hebrew Bible into English. The work had been begun by William Tyndale, who paid for it with his life, burnt at the stake in 1636. It was when he came to the word Chesed that he realized there was no English word which captured its meaning. It was then that, to translate it, he coined the term loving-kindness. The late Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, "When I was young, I admired cleverness. Now that I'm old, I admire kindness more." There's deep wisdom in those words. It is what led Eliezer to choose Rebekah to become Isaac's wife, and thus the first Jewish bride. Kindness brings redemption to the world, and, as in the case of Stephen Carter, it can change lives. Wordsworth was right when he wrote that the best portion of a good man's or woman's life is their little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Commentary on the Kindness of Strangers. The Parsha is Chai Sarah from the book of Genesis, and those commentaries is by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks. Well, got some other interesting stories for you. Let me talk about this one a little bit. Here's an article written by a man named Mendel Super. Bucking trends, he's talking about Chabad. He says $100 million in capital campaigns highlight Chabad's continued growth. You may be familiar with Chabad. They are an international movement, observant, religious, Jewish. And their purpose is Jewish outreach. That's all they're involved in. And they send their shluchim, what they call them, or emissaries, all over the world. They are everywhere, including Denver, Longmont, Boulder, Fort Collins, all over around here. Well, here's what this article has to say. When the world entered the COVID era in 2020, Life moved online fast. At first, it all seemed temporary. That's what the government said. Then COVID's long-term impact became more clear. Through 2020 and into 2021, almost every facet of Jewish community life became available online, and many questioned what the post-COVID Jewish communal future would look like. Pundits asserted many had become comfortable zooming in from home and simply wouldn't return to brick-and-mortar synagogues and community centers. But Chabad took a different tack. In the last 19 months, Chabad Lubavitch centers in the United States alone have launched more than $100 million in capital campaigns, pushing forward with hundreds of new centers and expanding or renovating existing ones. This optimistic outlook builds on a growth pattern that has been happening for decades. A 2020 study by urban and societal trends experts Joel Kotkin and Edward Heyman shows that amid a nationwide universal decline in the number of synagogues since the 2001 U.S. synagogue census, there's been almost a third, 29% drop. Chabad has been an outlier, experiencing threefold growth. During the same time frame, they found that the numbers of Chabad synagogues in the United States had gone from 346 to 1,036, with centers now in all 50 states. This number excluding Chabad on-campus chapters, mikvahs, schools, youth centers, and Chabad young professional communities. When COVID started, you already had a trajectory which, to a certain extent, carried Chabad forward and exacerbated the declines in other movements that they were experiencing. The physical centers reflect Chabad's interpersonal engagement. Pew Research Center's 2021 study of Jewish American life finds that 2 in 5 Jewish adults report engaging with Chabad Lubavitch. The Pew data also shows that Chabad attracts a diverse population. More than half of all participants personally identify as Reform, Conservative, or unaffiliated. A more detailed 2014 Miami Jewish community study echoed the nationwide trend, finding that 50% of Jews under 36 were active with Chabad. This trend of increasing engagement with Chabad only accelerated during the COVID pandemic. As early as March of 2020, when shops, offices, and restaurants were beginning to close their doors, some forever, and synagogues were canceling in-person services and classes, Chabad centers started adapting quickly, utilizing their decades of experience pioneering Jewish life on the Internet. Tens of thousands of children began logging onto Chabad Hebrew School, and Chabad rabbis and rebbetzins offered a steady stream of online classes and kids' activities, using their creativity to improvise virtual twists of anything that did not require in-person gatherings. But this virtual shift was always a stopgap measure. For Chabad emissaries around the world, who are gathering now in New York this week for the 38th Annual International Conference of Chabad Lubavitch Emissaries. They're called Kinus HaShluchim. It was obvious from day one that Zoom and other online platforms could never take the place of real, in-person human interaction, the type of active Jewish life that had sustained the Jewish people for millennia. Even when indoor spaces were shut, Chabad focused on safe opportunities for physical engagement. As the world eases into a post-COVID routine, people are increasingly turning to social communal engagement, and Chabad is well equipped to welcome them. "We knew things were going to rebound," says Rabbi Shmuley Levitin, co-director of Chabad Young Professionals of Hoboken and Jersey City. He and his wife Esta had been operating out of their family home with a vision to someday purchase a dedicated space for their programs. During COVID, we realized how critical the need for this space was, says Rabbi Levitin. We kept hearing from our community that it was Jewish life and connection that kept them going throughout the pandemic. Esther Levitin had been wistfully eyeing an ideal property in the heart of downtown Jersey City before the pandemic hit, but it came with a price tag to match. Then, as demand for real estate plummeted, so did its value, and the Levitins raised the opportunity to buy it with community members. The response was an outpouring of support, says Greg Edjo, a close friend of the Levitins and a commercial real estate broker who helped Chabad close the deal. We raised enough to close in 3 or 4 days, he said. It was a miracle. Edgel notes that Chabad's capital campaign attracted donors from across the board, including people who had never come before, like some of those whom he recruited to support the project, from family members to clients and colleagues. Supporting Chabad is a no-brainer because it is an investment that has the strongest spiritual return, says Elior Shiloh, another regular member and supporter. Rabbi and Rebbetzin Levitin open up their hearts and their home to everyone in the community, and their dedication is the spark that enables thousands of young professionals to live a Jewish lifestyle for themselves and their future families. Edgel echoes this sentiment. Their energy consumes you, and you just want a piece of it. You want to celebrate Judaism. When Edgel recently got engaged, he wasn't sure his fiancée would share his enthusiasm for Chabad. She was raised in a Reform background, he says, but she was cautiously optimistic. After she went to her first Rosh Hashanah service, she remarked that it was the most beautiful, resonant Jewish experience she had ever had. It was an aha moment as we build a family. Today, the first phase of construction is complete, and the center has already hosted a wedding, in addition to regular class and social events. It has indoor and outdoor space. It's perfect, says Esther Levitin. This center will serve our community's needs for years to come. One member, Jacques Aaron Price, serves as a trustee of the Philip Leonian and Edith Rosenbaum Leonian Charitable Trust. He was so impressed that the trust donated $2 million towards the purchase. His philosophy was simple. They say, if you build it, they will come. But I say, if you buy it, they will come. And they're coming. Raised in a Reform household himself, Price says there's an authenticity to Chabad, and their appeal is a non-judgmental attitude. The understanding that no one will start out doing 613 mitzvot, they focus on each mitzvah without criticizing. They are so welcoming. Price's wife, Evelyn, puts it plainly, it's not a diluted Judaism. But the new building could not have happened without the broader community believing in the vision as well, despite the uncertain times, and more than 500,000 in smaller donations came in towards acquiring the property. It's not just in the big cities where Chabad is thriving. As a Jewish demographic shift towards the south and the west is underway, what Haman and Kotkin call the out-migration of Jews from the big cities, Chabad is well positioned to embrace them with open arms. The biggest boom has undoubtedly been in Florida, some of it fueled by COVID migration from the northeast. The general trend of Jews leaving the northeast has become somewhat of an exodus recently. While those migration patterns were well established before the pandemic, Haman tells Chabad, we believe the pandemic added impetus to the move out of the large metropolitan areas to smaller cities, suburbs, and exurbs. Andrusier observes that since he opened his Chabad center in 1992, it has come from struggling to find 10 men for a weekday service in a trailer and rented storefront to closing mid-pandemic on a $4 million 6.5-acre former rehab center he has begun developing. That's a big project. We realized our potential to evolve into a major community center, remarks Andrews here. The sprawling new Chabad campus will ultimately include both women's and men's mikvahs, a dormitory for a teen summer program, and a high school for teens from across the country. The main building hosts a synagogue, cafeteria, and commercial kitchen. Another building overlooking a lake has been demolished, with the main synagogue sanctuary and hall to be built in its place. Chabad of Southwest Broward will now establish a preschool to cope with the burgeoning growth of the community. This is in Florida. Other Jewish preschools are full. There's no space. There's such high demand due to the influx of people from up north in California that we have no choice but to grow. Some communities are still on Zoom, but Chabad kept the focus on people, not digital platforms, and prepared to go back in a safe manner once vaccination became readily available. In addition to the influx of newcomers, Steiner sees another factor at play in Chabad's growth. Synagogues here are folding and merging with each other. There's not much left if you want something. Chabad is the best option. Meanwhile, in Bentonville, Arkansas, famous for being the birthplace and the headquarters of Walmart, Chabad completed a $1.4 million center. For the first few months of the pandemic, we were either on Zoom or outdoors, explains Rabbi Mendel Griesman, who directs Chabad of Northwest Arkansas with his wife Dobie. The Griesmans took the opportunity to develop deeper personal connections through one-on-one meetings and smaller in-person gatherings once deemed safe again. Joel and Irene Spalter have been attending Chabad of Northwest Arkansas on and off for a decade. Not always Chabad, though. We belong to another synagogue, which became less and less of a spiritual home for us, acknowledges Irene Spalter. Chabad was a better fit, they felt. We're used to a more traditional view of Judaism, a deeper view, she says. Every good deed counts at Chabad. When they ask you to wrap tefillin, you're accepted with enthusiasm. Nobody asks, how often will you do this? While Joel Spalter feels that an important aspect of Chabad's appeal is its adherence to tradition, Irene points to the warm and welcoming personas of the rabbi and the Rebbetzin, the shliach and the shlucha team. It's the ambiance, she says. If someone is ill or in trouble, Chabad will be the first to assist. I'm amazed by the Rebbe's teachings. They're a gift to the world. And when she says the Rebbe, she means Menachem Mendel Schneerson. He's also a blessed memory, but an amazing man. And he's the one referred to when they talk about Chabad's Rebbe. Joel notes that though Chabad never offered virtual Shabbat services, which would be prohibited by Jewish law, that didn't stop the rabbi from reaching out to people. Chabad was very cautious, but they get around because people come to them and the rabbi goes out to others, even speaking to them through their window. For the Spalters, the new building brings things full circle. They volunteered in Israel for their honeymoon, working at a kibbutz Kibbutz Lavi, in the north for 10 weeks, with which they developed a lifelong relationship. When the new sanctuary was being designed, they suggested one of the best-known names in synagogue furniture, Lavi Furniture, straight from the kibbutz, bringing a feel of the Holy Land into their shul in Arkansas. For 2 years, Rabbi Levi and Rishi Gurevich served for a permanent home for Chabad of Southlake, Texas. They found an old church for sale, but it was beyond their means. They kept searching and found a more modest building that was more affordable. But as they began negotiations, the owners pulled the property off the market. Devastated, Gurevich called his father. "You'll find something bigger. You'll find something better. You'll find something nicer," Rabbi Chaim Gurevich, the father, promised his son. "Stop worrying so much. Just continue doing your holy work." Days later, Gurevich's father was tragically killed in a car accident as he was distributing Shmura Matzah before Passover. "Those were his final words to me," says his son. "That day will stay for me forever." More determined than ever, Gurevich doubled down on Chabad of South Lake's growth. With the help of his family and community, he went back to the church he had dismissed as too out of reach and was able to close the deal. By Rosh Hashanah, 6 months later, Chabad was in its new home, although construction on the $3 million project is still ongoing. But despite demographic shifts, California remains a major population center and home to close to 2 million Jews. Chabad's presence on the West Coast dates back to 1949, when Rabbi Shmuel David Rechik and his wife Leah were sent there by the 6th Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, of righteous memory, to, quote, "awaken the hearts of our dear fellow brethren." In 1965, the Rebbe sent Rabbi Shlomo and Miriam Kunin to establish Chabad West Coast headquarters, and today there is more than 350 Chabad emissary couples that call California home. Rabbi Menachem and Adina Landa have been serving the town of Novato for a decade in what the rabbi calls the spiritual desert of Northern California. They got started without knowing anyone and hit the ground running. The Landas opened Chabad of Novato in 2012 in their 1,200-square-foot home, soon renting a 1,400-square-foot office space. They knew they'd need to expand their physical center to meet the needs of the flourishing community. "It wasn't a matter of if we'd purchase a larger community center," says Adina, "but when." After Rabbi Landa bought Hilda Nam, a 95-year-old Holocaust survivor in his community, to see a property that had come up, I said to her, "Hilda, this is the future of Yiddishkeit." Nam says that the Landas had been really generous to her mother. Previously, I was referring to her mother, Hilda. And the daughter says that the rabbi and his wife had been really generous to her mother during COVID, a frightening and lonely time for many seniors. He drove her 100 miles to see her brother. For the first time they'd met in a great number of years, Landa helped Hilda's brother, a 96-year-old Paul, put on tefillin for the first time since his bar mitzvah in pre-war Europe, before they had to flee to Shanghai. Luckily, they were able to flee to Shanghai. Hilda had always focused her giving on Judaism and Israel and told the rabbi she would become the lead donor for the project, and the new center will bear her name. But it was a group effort. Another community member, Gary Cohen, a commercial real estate agent in town, spearheaded the construction, while a committee of community members helped Landa raise the rest of the funds needed. The new 11,400-square-foot, $2.7 million center will house a synagogue, mikveh, preschool, and a youth lounge. "For 9 years," notes Landa, "we had to rent other venues for larger events. Our space was too small. Now, we have a place that people can feel is theirs." It's not that Chabad projects where people are going or which communities are growing better than others, observes Heyman, the demographer, and has thus been able to grow in the last 2 years. It's that Chabad simply goes where the Jews are. The Rebbe's vision of making sure the Jews were never forgotten and never alone anywhere in the world, and the movement to place emissaries in these environments means Chabad will more likely than not be there when a family moves into a new town. Whether there was or was not an existing Jewish infrastructure, Chabad became the point of Jewish presence. Haman also identifies a generational gap that Chabad has bridged, noting that it is able to attract not only college kids and families, but the tough demographic in between. It's the same warm and inviting atmosphere they remember from Chabad at college, and they can find a Chabad center wherever they've relocated. Ultimately, it's Chabad's authentic traditional perspective that appeals to people. If you're seeking tradition, Chabad is open and welcoming, says Haman. It's the return to basics which people find resonant. Well, interesting. There is a story about Chabad, the general movement of Chabad, and how it's been able to not only succeed, but to thrive. I should say, not only survive, but to thrive. It's really an amazing achievement. They have what they call shluchim, these emissaries, literally all over the world. They are in Asia, in Africa, they are in Russia, they are in America, Latin America. They are everywhere. And 70 years ago, approximately, at the end of World War II, all of the Orthodox Jews in Europe would fit in one large banquet room or one large hotel convention room, something like that. There was a few hundred. That's all there were left in the world. And now there are thousands, and they're all over the world, and there are more people studying Torah today than at any time, certainly in the modern era of Jewish history. Incredible success story, and Chabad is a big part of that. Well, here's a story. Probably you haven't heard it, about a camera designer. He manufactured the Leica camera, and there's a story behind it. Kind of a surprise to people. This article is written by George Gilbert, who is a photographer and a writer, and he told the story, this story at Lights, that's the company that makes Leica. It's called Lights, E. Lights and Company. He told the story at a convention of the Leica Historical Society of America. And he said, "I carry my Leica camera a bit more proudly these days. The reason? A story I had never heard before. A tale of courage, integrity, and humility that is only now coming to light some 70 years after the fact. The Leica is the pioneer 35mm camera. From a nitpicking point of view, it wasn't the very first still camera to use 35mm movie film, but it was the first to be widely publicized and successfully marketed. It created the candid camera boom of the 1930s. It is a German product, precise, minimalist, utterly efficient. Behind its worldwide acceptance as a creative tool was a family-owned, socially-oriented firm that, during the Nazi era, acted with uncommon grace, generosity, and modesty. E. Lights, Inc., designer and manufacturer of Germany's most famous photographic product, saved its Jews. And Ernst Leitz II, the steely-eyed Protestant patriarch who headed the closely held firm as the Holocaust loomed across Europe, acted in such a way as to earn the title the photography industry's Schindler. Well, for example, the company, founded in Wetzlar, Germany in 1869, had a tradition of enlightened behavior towards its workers. Pensions, sick leave, health insurance, all were instituted early on at Leitz, which depended on its workforce, depended for its workforce upon generations of skilled employees, many of whom were Jewish. As soon as Adolf Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany in 1933, Ernst Leitz II began receiving frantic calls from Jewish associates asking for his help in getting them and their families out of the country. As Christians, Leitz and his family were immune to Nazi Germany's Nuremberg laws, which restricted the movement of Jews and limited their professional activities. To help his Jewish workers and colleagues, Leitz quietly established what has become known among historians of the Holocaust as the Leica Freedom Train, a covert means of allowing Jews to leave Germany in the guise of Leitz employees being assigned overseas. Employees, retailers, family members, even friends of family members were assigned to Leitz sales offices in France, Britain, Hong Kong, and the United States. Leitz's activities intensified after the Kristallnacht of November 1938, during which synagogues and Jewish shops were burned all across Germany. Before long, German employees, so-called, were disembarking from the ocean liner Bremen at a New York pier and making their way to the Manhattan office of Leitz Incorporated, where executives quickly found them jobs in the photographic industry. Each new arrival had around their necks the symbol of freedom, a new Leica. The refugees were paid a stipend until they could find work. Out of this migration came designers, repair technicians, salespeople, marketers, and writers for the photographic press. The Leica Freedom Train was at its height in 1938 and early 1939, delivering groups of refugees to New York every few weeks. Then, with the invasion of Poland September 1, 1939, Germany closed its borders. By that time, hundreds of endangered Jews had escaped to America thanks to the Leitz's efforts. How did Ernst Leitz II and his staff get away with it? Leitz Incorporated was an internationally recognized brand that reflected credit on the newly resurgent Reich. The company produced rangefinders and other optical systems for the German military. Also, the Nazi government desperately needed hard currency from abroad, and Leitz's single biggest market for optical goods was the United States. Even so, members of the Leitz family and firm suffered for their good works. A top executive, Alfred Turk, was jailed for working to help Jews and freed only after the payment of a large bribe. Leitz's daughter, Elise Kuhn Leitz, was imprisoned by the Gestapo after she was caught at the border helping Jewish women cross into Switzerland. She eventually was freed but endured rough treatment in the course of questioning. She also fell under suspicion when she attempted to improve the living conditions of 700 to 800 Ukrainian slave laborers, all of them women, who had been assigned to work in the plant during the 1940s. After the war, Kuhn Leitz received numerous honors for her humanitarian efforts, among them the Officier d'Honneur de Palme Academic from France in 1965 and the Aristide Briand Medal from the European Academy in the 1970s. According to the late Norman Lipton, a freelance writer and editor, the Leitz family wanted no publicity for its heroic efforts. Only after the last member of the Leitz family did the Leica Freedom Train finally come to light. It's now the subject of a book, The Greatest Invention of the Leitz Family, The Leica Freedom Train, by Frank Dabba Smith, a California-born rabbi currently living in England. Interesting story. There were many people that helped the Jews, not the great masses by any stretch, but many people were righteous Gentiles. Here's an article, interesting article on Yitzhak Rabin's grandson. Not exactly making a great name for himself, unfortunately. It's a speech that he gave on the anniversary of Rabin's assassination. Here's not very flattering. Here's what he said. Here's a comment by a man, Yonatan Ben Artzi, claimed Netanyahu's ouster ended the hatred, the division, which tore Israeli society apart. But in the same breath, he himself sowed hatred and division. That's his name. This is Yitzhak Rabin's grandson, Yonatan Ben Artzi. Opposition leader and former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was notably absent from a state ceremony recently that marked 26 years since the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. But who can blame him? Ever since the assassination carried out by right-wing extremist Yigal Amir on November 4, 1995, the Rabin family has been blaming Netanyahu for allegedly inciting hatred that culminated in the murder. Netanyahu, who attended the annual ceremony each year when serving as prime minister, has repeatedly denied the allegations. In fact, addressing the Knesset ceremony later in the day, Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who leads the right-wing Yamina party, called for an end to the divisiveness, saying, "It wasn't the right or the religious who murdered Rabin. Yigal Amir murdered him." Yet, Yonatan Ben Artzi, Rabin's grandson, reaped division again this year and offended at least a quarter of the Israeli population at a graveside memorial by celebrating the end of the Netanyahu era and claiming it marked the end of, quote, "the hatred once again filled the streets, and the division which tore Israeli society apart." Despite his inability to form a coalition in the 120-seat Knesset, the Likud leader had more votes by far than any other candidate, winning 30 seats. Next in line was Yesh Atid party leader Yair Lapid, who garnered 17 seats, now serves as foreign minister and alternate prime minister. Bennett, the current prime minister, won a mere 7 seats. Nonetheless, Ben Artzi used his platform to slam Netanyahu and show contempt for his voters, claiming the former Israeli leader's ouster ended the hatred once again, filling the streets and the division which tore Israeli society apart. Returning to the end of Netanyahu's premiership, Ben Artzi said that in 2021 was a turning point. After dark years of fear and silence, the people of Israel stood up. Each Netanyahu victory over the course of his 15 years of leadership was gained through democratic elections and the will of the voters. Yet, according to Ben Artzi, quote, "After a long war for its freedom and democratic character, the people of Israel were victorious. Against open violence, both verbal and physical, facing a culture of dictatorship and lies, the Israeli spirit triumphed, and government of the people defeated the government of the individual." That's a quote by Mr. Ben Artzi. Furthermore, he said, "For the last quarter century, Israel has been suffering from post-trauma, which is being fueled by those people who can take delight in the pain. But I can say that this morning, 26 years after that terrible night, I can tell you that now that terrible period is over." Lapid also took the opportunity, at an event that should have been a solemn occasion and a call for unity, to attack his political opponents, saying, "The last election was a referendum on democracy, on the question of whether we still want to live in a democratic regime with a rule of law, or whether we want to move to a populist, authoritarian, extremist, and nationalist regime." Ironically, Lapid trailed behind Netanyahu. Netanyahu, who attended the Knesset event, responded, Over the years, I have heard at these events abusive and false claims about the camp I represent and about me personally. But I gritted my teeth, I restrained myself, I fulfilled my duty to be there as Prime Minister in accordance with the state protocol. We treat the late Yitzhak Rabin with deep respect for his many virtues, for his great contributions to Israel's security, and yet we do not hide for a moment the disagreements between us. This is statesmanship, he declared. In 2019, responding to that year's attack by Ben Artzi on the former premier, Netanyahu responded, "The memorial has become a disgraceful political outburst. They take advantage of the official memorial ceremony for false political propaganda. We see a direct link between this disrespectful behavior and the difficulty of uniting people and healing a wound." Indeed. Well, now you know a little bit about Yitzhak Rabin's grandson, Yonatan Ben Artzi, and the Israeli left is very much like the American left. And when they talk about lack of respect and difficulty uniting the people, much of it comes from our political leaders, sorry to say. Well, we have an election coming up, as you know, and we just have just about enough time for me to share this little story with you, which I think you'll find interesting. Just hold it in your mind when you submit your ballot, if you haven't mailed it in already. Well, while walking down the street one day, a member of Congress was tragically hit by a truck and died. His soul arrived in heaven and was met by St. Peter at the entrance. "Welcome to heaven," says St. Peter. "Before you settle in, it seems there is a problem. We seldom see a high official around these parts, you see, so we're not sure just what to do with you." "No problem," says the man. "Just let me in." "Well, I'd like to, but I have orders from higher up. What we'll do is have you spend one day in hell and one day in heaven, and then you can choose where you will spend eternity." "Well, really, I've already made up my mind. I want to be in heaven," says the congressman. Well, Peter replies, "I'm sorry, but we have our rules." And with that, St. Peter escorts him to the elevator, and he goes down, down, down to hell. The doors open, and he finds himself in the middle of a green golf course. In the distance is a clubhouse, and standing in front of it are all his friends and other politicians who had worked with him. Everyone is very happy and in evening dress. They run to greet him, shake his hand, and reminisce about the good times they had while getting rich at the expense of the people. They play a friendly game of golf and then dine on lobster, caviar, and champagne. Also present is the devil, who really is a very friendly and nice guy who has a good time dancing and telling jokes. They're having such a good time that before he realizes it, it is time to go. Everyone gives him a hearty farewell and waves while the elevator rises. Now the elevator goes up, up, up to heaven, and the door reopens where St. Peter is waiting for him. Now it's time to visit heaven. So 24 hours pass with the congressman joining a group of contented souls, moving from cloud to cloud, playing the harp and singing. They have a good time, and before he realizes it, the 24 hours have gone by, and St. Peter returns. "Well then, you've spent a day in hell and another day in heaven. Now, choose your eternity." Well, the congressman reflects for a minute and then answers, "Well, I would never have said it before. I mean, heaven has just been delightful, but I think I would be better off in hell." So, St. Peter escorts him to the elevator, and he goes down, down, down to hell. Now the doors of the elevator open, and he's in the middle of a barren land covered with waste and garbage. He sees all his friends, dressed in rags, picking up the trash and putting it in black bags as more trash falls from above. The devil comes over to him and puts his arm around his shoulder. "I don't understand," stammers the congressman. "Yesterday I was here and there was a golf course and a clubhouse. We ate lobster and caviar. We drank champagne and danced and had a great time. Now there's just a wasteland full of garbage and my friends all look miserable. What happened?" The devil looks at him and smiles and says, "Yesterday we were campaigning and today you voted." Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you appreciate that story. I want to thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin, and I'd like to wish all of you in parting a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week, and don't forget to vote.